This episode of The Fern Line is supported by Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Are you searching for ways to increase your mental focus in the mountains and in life? Look no further than Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Owned and operated by prolific alpinist Sam Johnson, Behind the Sun Therapeutics is a private mental health and mental coaching practice based in Seward, Alaska. Sam, who is featured on the Fernline episode Mindful Mountaineer, has made numerous first ascents spanning from Alaska, Asia, and many places in between. Sam is excited to offer performance-oriented mental coaching for risk-oriented sports to clients based around the world, as well as mental health services for clients within the state of Alaska. For more information, contact Behind the Sun Therapeutics via phone at 907-422-7504 or by email at behindthesuntherapeutics@gmail.com.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On each episode, I speak with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild places on the planet. Thanks for listening. And we're just going to dive into it today. On today's episode of The Fern Line, we'll delve into the final segment of a two-part series with Canadian Rockies legend Barry Blanchard. In the first episode, we heard Barry tell stories of his early years in the Canadian Rockies, as well as some of the formative partnerships he developed during that time. We heard about iconic routes like the Andromeda Strain, the North Pillar on North Twin, and the east face of Mount Fay, to name a few. But there was one mountain, a mountain that is central to my own climbing career, that I wanted to spend a little more time talking with Barry about. And that majestic peak is Mount Robson. Rising over 10,000 feet from the Fraser River Valley, Robson is the highest mountain in the Canadian Rockies. It's also one of the most recognizable mountains in North America, if not the world, drawing hundreds of thousands of tourists each year, hoping to catch a glimpse of its frosty summit. But to mountaineers, Robson is much more than a photo opportunity. Rather, it is a sacred destination, a place to test oneself. All the mountain's aspects feature classic lines, and some walls, like the Emperor Face, harbor some of the biggest and most challenging lines in North America. One of these lines is called Infinite Patience, a route Barry established up the right side of the Emperor Face in 2002 with partners Eric Dumerac and Philippe Pellet. I asked Barry to talk about his years-long obsession with Robson, why the mountain is so meaningful to him, and what it took to finally make it up Infinite Patience after years of attempts.
first time I went in there was with Kevin Doyle and Ron Humble and Stuart Broker, you know, part of my early 80s posse, or my early 80s posse, basically. And we walked all the way in there to below. We were going to go to the North Face, actually, and got rained on and walked out. So then I became a guide, and I guided Mount Robson, you know, for the next couple decades. Probably guided it a half a dozen times, so I got much more familiar with the mountain. But during that time also, you know, after we, Ward Robinson and I put up the route on Howes Peak in the winter of 88, we really felt the next logical step in winter alpinism in the Canadian Rockies, which David had contributed to, Dave Cheeseman had contributed to so much, was to go to the Emperor Face in winter. And I went there in 1989 with Jim Elzinga and Ward Robinson. And we took a helicopter into the base, and not many mountains you can do that in the Rockies. So we took advantage of that on Robson. Jim paid for the helicopter, God bless him. And we, you know, got out of there and out of the helicopter, went up, put in a snow cave at the base of the Emperor Face, had a good night, kicked out the door. It was absolutely blue, calm sky, but it was minus 40, which is the same in Celsius or Fahrenheit, same temperature. So we looked up at the Emperor Face, and Jim said, if we try climbing technically in these temperatures, we're going to get frostbitten. And I said, yeah, I think so. And Ward looked down and spat. So we just said, okay, let's go to the North Face. So we, you know, went shooting up to the North Face, put another snow cave, climbed the North Face in minus 40, which the only way you can really do it is to get across the bergschrund with the rope, then take off the rope and just all solo together, because otherwise you will get frostbitten.
Yeah, damn.
And you know, it was always in the radar, you know, the Emperor Face of Robson in winter. And I didn't get it together to go in there again until 97, I guess, with Steve House and Joe Josephson. And it was Joe Josephson and I who were planning it. And Grant Statham was going to come in with us, but he had to cancel. So Joe, out of the blue, called up Steve House. And I'd met Steve the year before in Cody, Wyoming, at the Gathering, you know, the week before Christmas. A bunch of us would converge down on Cody in the 90s and have the Gathering and just go climb ice. And I was having breakfast the last morning that Steve House and Steve Swenson and Tom Hargis were there from Seattle. And I think Steve had gotten up to go to the washroom, and Steve Swenson said to me, you should take Steve on one of your climbs in the wintertime in the Rockies. He's really good. And I said, okay. And Joe called him, and Steve said, I'll start driving tonight. I can be there.
Nice.
So that's kind of the first time I climbed with Steve House, was that winter, our first annual attempt and failure to climb Mount Robson. So, you know, every winter after that, the next winter, we didn't get the weather. We went and did a route called the Silver Lining with JoJo. The next winter, we went up there, didn't get the weather. We went and climbed the east face of Howes Peak, M16, Scott Backes and Steve and I. And then the next winter, we did get in there. But I guess to track back to the first annual attempt to climb Mount Robson is when Steve dropped the plunger to the stove. And after our 5,000-foot first day, and, you know, Steve spends hours pulling stuff apart and the plunger's gone, so he can't compress the fuel. He tries to make a plunger out of a spare washer I have in the stove kit, and after, you know, an hour of frostbiting cold, he gets a quarter cup of slush water. So we're gonna have to go down. And Steve was so depressed.
Oh, I bet.
You know, he's a young tiger. And I remember looking at him and saying, you know, Steve, at the end of your life, when you sum up all the fuck-ups you're going to make, this is going to seem like pretty small change. And he goes, gee, thanks, Bubba. So, yeah, 2000, we got in there again, JoJo and Steve and I, and we were making a film, and we did the same 5,000-foot first day in a storm, and we came down. And then 2001, our fifth or sixth annual attempt and failure to climb Mount Robson, we ended up on the Actually on Mount Fay. Did a route called Sands Blitz with Rolando Garibaldi because the weather was too not good enough for Robson. So, yeah, that summer or spring, Steve came up with Rolando. I couldn't go. So that was, I think, the seventh annual attempt and failure to climb Mount Robson. And then in the fall, things came together condition-wise, and Eric Dumerac gave me a call, a buddy of mine up here, fellow mountain guide, and one of his buddies from France, Philippe Pellet, another mountain guide, was here climbing. And they said, we're going to Robson. Do you want to come? And I cleared my calendar and took a helicopter in there. And, yeah, we finally were able to get up Infinite Patience. And Steve and, or not Steve, but Eric and Philippe named it Infinite Patience because I, you know, expressed infinite patience in getting up the route. And it was a really good route. It is a really good route, although one that is narrowing down with ice loss, you know, as we speak. Not as we speak. It's cold enough up there right now. That, but this last summer, hopefully it gained some ice volume, maybe.
Maybe, you know, for the folks who will listen to the podcast who are really just interested in climbing in Robson, can you kind of describe that route? I know it kind of starts with like a... like a fairly straightforward couloir for, you know, I don't know, 1,000 or 2,000 feet?
Yeah. When you look at the Emperor Face at Mount Robson above Berg Lake, and above Berg Lake it presents 7,000 feet of relief. And interestingly, Mount Robson from the Fraser River on the west side presents 10,000 feet of relief.
Stunning.
Which is equal size of a mountain when you're at Everest Base Camp in Tibet and you look to the summit of Everest, you're looking at 10,000 feet of relief. So the mountains are the same size. It's just one of them starts, you know, at 18,000 feet, whereas the other one starts at 3,000 feet.
Yeah.
But they are the same size. And yeah, when you look at the Emperor Face from Berg Lake, you'll notice, anyone will notice, two striking linear features on the right side of the face. And that is the route that we established called Infinite Patience. And oddly enough, one of the very, probably the hardest climbing we did was far below that initial couloir, just getting up a rock band at the bottom of the face. We ended up climbing, you know, water, ice, and mixed pitch that had only formed like 3 or 4 days, over the 3 or 4 days previous.
So it was probably pretty thin.
Well, no, it was healthy where it was water ice. It was newborn water ice, but it was honest, you know, I don't know, M5 or M6 mixed climbing and a traverse, and got pretty exciting with me, with my pack, trying to follow this traverse and thinking I'm going to fall off till I can shuck this pack off my back and have it go penduluming over and slam into this other side of the pitch that I would have slammed into if I still had the pack on my back. But good to get the... I think I called it a 40-pound sack of green shit off my back because I hated it at that point because it was trying to pull me off. So the hardest climbing was probably there, and then, you know, water ice four. But then you get up into this ancient green ice couloir, such a deep, deep feature on Robson that it actually has the stencil of a large ice feature that would have fallen away sometime in the last 100 years. So when these hanging ice features or small hanging glaciers fall away, they leave a footprint visible in the ice face. And you can see one on the north face of Mount Athabasca, actually, where there was a hanging glacier there in the 40s, but it fell off. And it's the stencil of it is still in the ice face. So this deep, you know, ice couloir has that at the top of it. So, yeah, you spend a day getting up to below that couloir. We spent a night. The next day we went up the couloir and then traversed over and joined the next linear feature, which is the, you know, brilliant part of Infinite Patience. So some, you know, mixed, moderate mixed climbing to make that link up. And then you're just into this, you know, Emilio Camisi, the... Dolomitic climber from the Dolomites, oddly enough, before the Second World War, said, "Let a drop of water fall from the summit, and that's where I shall climb."
Nice.
Although apparently he lifted that quote from a British climber, and then him and his Italian buddy got in an argument about where the drop of water would exactly go down the north face of the Tre Cime. We followed this strip of ice that was, you know, several meters wide or, you know, 10 feet wide, maybe as narrow as 5 feet wide at times, for half a dozen rope lengths into the sky. You know, it's Jack's Beanstalk or Emilio Camisi's drop of water frozen in time. And it was absolutely magic climbing, just beautiful, beautiful climbing, pitch after pitch, good rock, perfect ice, you know, challenging enough, just fun. And at the top of that feature, you join on to the Emperor Ridge, you know, originally climbed in the 60s by Ron Perla, who still lives here in Canmore, and his buddy from, they were both snow rangers down in Utah at the time. And then you end up, you know, ascending the Emperor Ridge in winter conditions. And Philippe dropped his second ice axe of the route up there. So he'd managed to drop two ice axes on the route. And he blamed it on the fact that he put wrist loops on his ice axes because he'd been climbing for 6 years without wrist loops. But it meant that the leader got two ice axes, and the second, you know, Eric and I, if we're following Philippe, we got one ice axe apiece. And I figured we could drop one more ice axe and still be okay.
Right.
But, the traverse at the top, you know, the Emperor Ridge proper goes through the gargoyles, these rime formations that are 30 to 60 feet high and are like, you know, match strikes frozen. So you strike a match and that big plume of flame that comes off the top, freeze that in ice. And that is these 60 or 80 foot high rime formations along the Emperor Ridge. You know, it's otherworldly. You just don't see it anywhere else in the Rockies. No other peak is high enough to have that formation. Only the King, only the very highest peak in the Canadian Rockies. And they are, unfortunately, a hassle to climb through. So we traversed right for a kilometer on 45-degree ice along a feature that the Shuswap Indians used to name the mountain. They call it the Mountain of the Spiral Road, Yahahushkin, and might be my native heritage that led us out onto this ice face. And for a kilometer, you go sideways on 45-degree ice, and anyone who's ever climbed 45-degree ice will know within a rope length, your calves have turned to stone, and you're praying for any feature to put your foot sideways on,
right,
for enough technique to do pied troisième and get the weight off of your calf muscles, or right, a rock that's sticking out of the ice face that you can get a foot sideways on, and just try to deal with the napalm that is pulsing through your calf muscles. So, yeah, you've done it. You know. Yeah. I can tell by the way you're laughing at
it. Well, especially with a heavy pack after climbing for multiple,
That was our third day, and we hit the summit via a gully that Don Clouch used to finish the Emperor, the Wishbone Arete, also in the 60s. We hit the summit at midnight, and it was amazing. You know, we hugged each other, and we howled, and we screamed, and we cried a bit, and went down and dug a bivvy. And the next day, we came up and got pictures on the summit, and I could see, when I measured the mountain in the north that I could see relative to the one in the south, we had 200 miles of visibility.
Wow.
Which you can get off the summit of Denali, but you have to really know what you're looking at to the north.
Right.
And the south. Yeah.
Yeah, stunning. Yep. It's not too often that you probably get visibility like that off Robson.
Yeah. You know, I was in a panel discussion about photography or Mount Robson a couple years ago at the Bam Mountain Film Festivals, and some of the photographers were talking about, you know, the best picture you can get of Mount Robson, and I just had to do a, you know, breaker, guys, you know, any day you can see Mount Robson is an absolute perfect picture of Mount Robson.
Exactly.
Because there's, you can go by that mountain every day for a month and only see it 2 days out of that month. So any day you can see it is the perfect picture of Mount Robson.
You know, maybe it's changed. You know, there was a period of time where, like I said, the first time I went in there was October of 1997. Mm-hmm. And essentially just did a recon. But it kind of set in stone my infatuation with that peak. I think the next year I went back in September and tried to climb the North Face, and had we got up there, you know, climbed the Rock Band, got up there, did the bivvy, and the net, and it was in perfect shape. I mean, blue, perfect ice. But we couldn't get across this massive crevasse.
Yeah, I can see that.
And then I think a year or two later, I went back and succeeded in climbing the Cane Face, which was a great climb, you know?
Yeah.
And a great adventure walking in there and going up the Robson Glacier, and it came together, but it took me 3 tries. And I know that, and I'm coming from Alaska, you know, but I know that there are some climbers, really good climbers, better than me, who've tried it more times than that and not been able to get up it.
Yeah, a lot of stuff has to come together. And, you know, you climb the Cane Face and think about Conrad Cain, you know, guiding that in the early 1900s, cutting steps.
Yeah, I mean, that's just unbelievable.
Surviving an open bivouac on the glaciers on the south side, getting down and doing the descent on site. Yeah, amazing. He was the best mountain guide and alpinist at the same time in North America at that point in time.
Right.
And what's mind-blowing about Cain is the next time he went to Robson was the next annual general mountaineering camp of the Alpine Club of Canada in the 20s. And he went up and down Robson from McKinney Lake. He'd ride a horse till there. He went up and down the mountain 4 times in 2 weeks. The physicality of it is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Killian Jornet would say, wow.
Right.
He went up and down Robson 4 times in 2 weeks.
I've climbed big mountains, and you know Robson is, you know, it's no joke.
Yeah,
it's no joke by any route.
Yeah.
Seems like a hard way to find yourself when your feet never touch the ground.
It was a privilege to speak with Barry so candidly about his life and climbing career. To hear those stories firsthand, the stories that inspired me as a young alpinist in the early 90s, is something I certainly will cherish in my own life. But I was also impressed by Barry's humble manner, the way he spoke about his friend's accomplishments before his own. I could also hear the reflection in his voice, the wisdom of thousands of days in the mountains, and the hard lessons learned in the great ranges and in life. Before we ended our conversation, I asked Barry to reflect on his life in the mountains, what he's learned along the way, and what he looks forward to in the future.
In my late 20s, I went through a catabasis, you know, a fall through the bottom with my first divorce. And soon after, around that time, actually, you know, one of my other really important partners came into my life, Mark Twight. And we were good at pushing the black for each other, and black poetry, black music, a lot of punk. We became kind of arrogant and rebellious and quite driven. Climbing, you know, was our religion, and that's what made sense of the universe for us. We pursued it with everything we had. It's nice to have had the mountains, you know, take that energy and direct it, and also, I guess, adjudicate it, kind of put it in its place that, you know, we're, you know, whatever hubris I had, I think the mountains kicked it out of me. And I'm grateful for that. I, Yeah, I think a more humble and a humble approach is a better approach, and whatever humility, you know, I've gained has been largely through the mountains. And they're kind of a never-ending teacher. And I got a lot of gray hair now. And I'd like to think that at this point in my life, hopefully I'm getting some things figured out and will be worthy of being considered an elder in this tribe of climbers, and may have hopefully some things that I can share and pass on, and will help younger folk, and help anyone basically. You know, not to, you know, I'm learning all the time, and I always think of a Leonard Cohen song. When Leonard Cohen's talking about songwriting and being in the tower of song, and I often equate this to writing, but Leonard Cohen is saying, you know, I hear Hank coughing all night long, 100 floors above me in the tower of song. And he's talking about Hank Williams. And we're all on an ascent, you know, and it's a never-ending ascent through life. So wherever I'm at along that side of that mountain, I think the summit's still a long, long ways off if it ever is ever attained. But wherever I'm at the ascent, there's people ahead of me and people behind me, and people at the same level. And whatever I can share that'll help in the ascent, I'm hoping that this is the point in my life where I can do that.
Awesome, man. In your opinion, what's the future of alpinism in the Canadian Rockies?
You know, there's, I think there'll be more lines, added to some of the big faces and more, you know, challenging routes put up on some of the big faces like, Marc-Andre and Luca's route in the Valley of the Ten Peaks. On Mount Tuzo. And I think they're favoring that place because there is some quartzite there, and quartzite's definitely a better medium to climb on than limestone. And like the direct finish that just got done by Inez and Luca on Mount Faye, that's just so cool to see. And then, you know, there's just so much talent around now. You know, you have guys like Johnny Walsh who are, you know, putting up roots, hard roots, and Raphael Slowinski, you know, and some young guys just this last week put a route up on Mount Bell. It just looks brilliant, you know, just fabulous. Not the biggest face in the Canadian Rockies, but just looks like a great technical route. Gets me inspired to, man, I want to get up there and do that route kind of deal. And there are still some big faces that don't have roots on them. So some that need roots put on them. And, you know, so much of what we do is in the central part of the Rockies. And the Canadian Rockies geographically go from Bozeman, Montana to the Liard River in the Northwest Territories. They're over 1,000 kilometers long. So there's so much of the north part of the range and even the south part of the range that I don't know about, a lot of people don't know about. Some people do know about stuff in the south part of the range. Montanans are infamous for not talking a whole bunch about what they do. But there's other big faces out there. So there's going to be more faces done for sure, more fine adventures. But there's a lot out there. And I really look forward to seeing what gets done in the northern and southern parts of the range, as well as what happens in the central part of the range, the more kind of explored part.
Right. I think it's important too to also, you know, just to be able to reflect on just the fact that, like, even if you're not doing first ascents in the Canadian Rockies, I mean, there is a lifetime of just great adventure climbing, you know, of any grade in the range.
If people are looking for high altitude experience, like altitude experience, the Rockies aren't exceptionally high, but pretty much any other experience in what we call mountaineering that you're looking for, you'll find it here in the Rockies. And a lot of the places, like one of the things I've said about North Twin, still the case, it gets seen more by grizzly bears than it does by human beings. So yeah.
You might have already mentioned this, but who are some of the alpinists out there who inspire you today?
Yeah, well, Johnny Walsh comes right to my mind, although Johnny's not a young guy anymore. And Marc-Andre Leclerc was, you know, amazingly inspiring. And it's, he's gone now. Something went wrong, had some bad luck. And I think a lot of people looking at Marc-Andre's climbing would have thought he would have died soloing, but he died, sounds like, in a rappelling mishap with an avalanche. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's cool to hang out with Luca and Inez, and some of the other young guys around here who get me fired out. Martin, you know, he lives out in Exshaw. He's got a, you know, exotic Dutch last name that's hard to pronounce.
Right.
And then,
is he the one who with Joss climbed Infinite Patience last year?
I think so. Yeah. Martin did. Yeah. And then there's other young guys that some of which I've met. Some of the other, you know, Quentin Roberts is just, yeah. And, you know, I have climbed a bit with Quentin, so he's, you know, amazing and doing amazing things, as is Alec Berg. And funny, Alec Berg, I climbed with his father, Reinhard Berg, back in the day. So, yeah, I'm almost getting lost by generation here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to think, back, in the late 70s and early 80s, in the mid 80s, when you were doing really, really hard climbing in the mountains, and to think about the tools you guys were using back then. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind when you were talking about hanging off Carl's tools that he jumped off on Mount Fay is like, yeah, I hung off those and put in a screw. Well, the screws back there, back then, I mean, I don't know what you were using, but the first thing that comes to mind are those ratchet Chouinard screws that you got to put in with a ratchet. I mean, the tools back then were just, it's nothing like today.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was climbing on stew bys, and we had Chouinard tubular screws, which were actually a miracle when they came about. They were so much better than the Saluda screws. And,
right.
You know, Yvon's tubular, especially the, I don't know if he had a stainless steel coated one, but some of the ones that had a smoother coating were definitely a revolution. That's about the time I really got into ice climbing. And I remember Carl, I'm pretty sure he was on X15s when he was on the pillar on Mount Fay. And the technology, especially in ice climbing, technology and technique, all the dry tooling, you know, the roadside dry tooling, bolted cragging kind of stuff has really revolutionized the way we use the pick in the Alpine. Not so much the crampon point, but definitely the pick. And then, you know, the ease of the ice screws, how fast they go in and how easily they go in. We don't have to carry a third tool anymore to crank them in.
Right.
So, yeah. And then, you know, amount of time and training and technique that people bring into alpinism now, largely because of the revolution in rock climbing and rock gyms and rock technique, is amazing. It's amazing how hard people climb now. Although the inner experience, I think, in the Alpine is pretty much the same. You know, you push yourself hard, you use all the skills you have, you get on the verge of falling and hopefully you don't fall, and you get on the verge of what you're able to understand and intuit and survive on the side of a mountain, and you push that. And those experiences, you know, they look different from the 30s to the 40s to the 60s to the, you know, the 90s to where we are now. But if you get inside the heart and the minds of those alpinists, they're having the same experience. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And I would say, too, it's like the Canadian Rockies. It's kind of like Alaska, or I guess maybe any great mountain range. There's not really a replacement for real experience, you know, whether you're succeeding or failing. Just being out there and getting the experience and the days and the pitches under your belt, you know, you can learn a lot on a roadside crag, but I think that time spent in the mountains, and especially a place like the Canadian Rockies, is really invaluable.
Yeah, well, when Kelly Cordes and Scott DiCaprio came down from making an ascent of virtual reality, like threadbare ascent, but pretty much as little ice as you could have on the route and still have it be possible. And they get down, they've had their minds blown, and yeah, that was pretty good, acting like they do that kind of thing all the time. And then Scott was later to say, yeah, people say the Rockies are good training for the Alaska Range. That's bullshit, man. Alaska Range is good training for the Rockies.
Yeah. And you know what? I would second that.
Yeah.
Okay. So kind of winding down here. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, Barry. What's the most important piece of wisdom you can give to an aspiring Canadian Rockies alpinist?
Probably the same stuff that was given to me by the older British climbers that first season in Chamonix. It was tread lightly, lad, and take your time. And I think specifically for a Canadian Rockies alpinist, as much as it is so intoxicating to get into rock climbing and ice climbing and mixed climbing and start playing in the alpine, from day one, start developing your snow education. Start reading books about avalanche phenomena. Get the education. And if you're serious about becoming an alpinist, get the professional education. Like get the Canadian Avalanche Association starting on their courses. Because so many people in alpinism die with avalanche. And there's a lot there. There's a lifetime of learning with avalanche. And start right away. Don't neglect it, because it's not as fun. Snow climbing just usually isn't as fun as ice climbing or rock climbing or mixed climbing, but it's the one that probably takes the most lives in the mountains. So, yeah.
Right. And then, and conversely, I'm going to put you on the spot even more. What's the most important piece of life wisdom you could give?
Huh. Life wisdom. Wow. I think, you know, I think listen to your heart. Like, make your decisions from the heart. I think just for life as a whole palette. Don't make as many decisions from your brain. Yeah, make them from your heart. That's the place that I think real wisdom resides. So that would be my advice.
I'm done pretending that I could be...
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today, folks. I hope you got as much out of Barry's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his life and alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Hey, remember to check out Barry's book, The Calling. It's a classic, and you can find it over at Patagonia or any good place books are sold. As always, thank you so much for all your continued support for the podcast. If you're looking for a way to support this show, you can leave a review over on Apple Podcasts or become a monthly subscriber over on Patreon. And speaking of Patreon, I want to give a huge shout out to Leo Franchi for supporting each month at the executive producer level. All right, friends, well, please take care of yourselves. Be safe out there in the mountains, and we will see you next time on The Firm Line. We should stay friends for just a little while longer till it goes on.